It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in the aftermath of the protests in Ferguson, our guest talks about how and why to be a white ally to the African-American community.
First, the death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa this week rose to over 2,000.
The World Health Organization predicts it'll take at least 6 to 9 months and at least $600 million to bring the current outbreak under control. During those months, at least 20,000 more people are likely to be infected, they say, and half will likely die.
Well, only 3 cases have been reported in the United States so far, all of them aid workers who picked up the virus in Africa. The disease may still seem like a distant worry.
With us now is Paul Biodritsky. He's Director of Disease Control and Environmental Health at the City of Milwaukee Health Department and adjunct faculty at the UW-Milwaukee Zilber School of Public Health. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Paul, watching from Milwaukee, can you first give us a snapshot of the current outbreak of Ebola?
Yeah, it's still primarily centered in 4 countries in Africa, and there are really tremendous, almost unprecedented efforts on behalf of the World Health Organization and CDC to suppress, quench, and control the outbreak. And as you mentioned, they're predicting that it'll most likely continue to occur for 6 to 9 months, but things don't need to seem that dire. It does appear that there is some progress being made if we continue to sustain the influx of resources and attention to the outbreak, which, again, is thousands of miles away, but has potential impact globally.
And you recently wrote a piece, I think it was in the Journal Sentinel, in effect making the case that, yes, this is far away, but yes, we should really care and be paying attention. Why is that?
Yeah, this really it was my vision around global health security, which is really a 21st century term, and it really refers to the fact that novel emerging infectious diseases can be easily transplanted thousands of miles away due to air travel and population mobility, which continues to increase in this century. So we've seen it with SARS in 2003. We've seen some of it with pandemic influenzas, including H5N1 and H1N1 this past pandemic in 2009. So we know that these diseases, although they appear to be far away, can be in our doorstep in a matter of hours, if not days.
And even beyond the diseases themselves, when we start having travel bans, and we start, in effect, shutting off, turning off the taps of the economy in different places around the world, that has effects where they're experiencing the disease and beyond.
Absolutely, and this is especially pronounced in poor developing countries, as we're seeing with Ebola. There's limited access or availability to health care. Resources are limited, and in densely populated urban centers, you can have this diseases like Ebola, be readily transmitted. It does have tremendous economic impact, and it also has this specter of stigmatization, and we're seeing that with Ebola, where people now are fearful of the disease, and those that may have been exposed, infected, are moving farther away instead of seeking medical treatment, which makes it very challenging to control or suppress.
Now, the point you make in that piece I mentioned is that this isn't a wake-up call. The wake-up call was when the more remote rural outbreaks of Ebola happened. Did we answer that wake-up call at the time?
You know, unfortunately, we haven't, and I think many experts would agree. These were smaller outbreaks or clusters of disease in remote areas, rural remote areas, and they disappeared on their own. So really, we're a little behind the curve in terms of developing effective medical countermeasures. One reason you're seeing a lot of attention now being focused on experimental vaccines and drugs like ZMapp, which is a monoclonal antibody drug that's very experimental. And, you know, this disease was discovered 40 years ago. We had ample time to really study and develop medical countermeasures. But because of the small clusters and outbreaks that were primarily remote and self-suppressed, there really wasn't much attention spent or focused on the disease.
So the head of the World Health Organization frames this as a war and says one of the things we need is more troops, medical troops. What doctors, nurses, other healthcare workers with the right gear that they need. How can the U.S. and the rest of the international community help make sure those medical troops are available?
Yeah, and that's a really good point. As we saw with SARS in 2003, private healthcare or healthcare workers are on the front lines of fighting infectious disease, and they're one of the strongest allies of public health in that regard. So, again, part of this is building awareness among the population, not only providing healthcare providers to the affected region, but really building awareness among the general public of what the disease is and what it isn't, and encouraging, again, individuals that are symptomatic to either self-isolate or seek medical care. The United States and other countries should pay particular attention to what's happening in Africa, because it is a poor continent, poor country, strife with civil unrest. There is a lot of political unrest. Many poor populations in densely populated urban areas. So it's a matter of not only providing the personnel, but also the medical capability. And that means resources such as personal protective equipment. And as medical countermeasures become available, certainly we want to send that towards those countries as well. And I think there has been progress made. We've seen four countries impacted fairly rapidly. It's been about 3 weeks now, and we haven't seen additional countries brought into the fold. That doesn't mean we're out of the woods, but it provides some glimmer of hope that perhaps some of the efforts underway, the public health intervention measures, are taking hold.
What do you make of what the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has done so far here in the United States in addressing Ebola?
Well, I've been very impressed, and I've been in public health now some 31 years, and I think their response has been unprecedented in terms of working not only with the World Health Organization, but state and local health agencies, such as the City of Milwaukee. We've seen them send out guidance very rapidly through health alert networks on enhancing surveillance for travelers that may be symptomatic or visiting these countries that have been impacted. We've seen them provide key messaging and talking points to local and public state public health agencies. And then also they've been very good at keeping us up to date on medical countermeasure development, whether that be vaccines, antivirals, or new types of experimental drugs. So I think they're taking this sufficiently seriously and really sharing information in a way that they previously have not, with state and locals, to have us lean forward in terms of the potential for the disease occurring here in the U.S. And right now we know that risk is very low. The three cases that are in the U.S. have all been imported as a result of healthcare providers being exposed overseas and then being transported to the U.S. for medical treatment. So right now the risk is very low. This is a disease that requires direct contact with bodily fluids, including blood, vomit, feces, saliva, but generally the people at highest risk are healthcare providers, individuals who come into contact with infected patients. Those are two of the highest risk groups. And again, the general populace in the U.S. is not at high risk at this time.
I know when it comes to future diseases, it's hard to predict when, where, what, and how things will develop. But are there infrastructures you would like to see in place around the world to prepare for these kind of outbreaks that aren't currently in place?
Yes, I think the relationship between the World Health Organization and CD is absolutely critical in establishing, at least foundationally, better coordinating protocols, some perhaps international health policies, and then engaging the world in global mutual aid agreements that would address these types of outbreaks very, very rapidly. I think all of those are being discussed, potentially developed in the coming years, but I think what we're seeing now is a great opportunity to begin that dialogue strategically in developing those types of tools for future outbreaks of similar characteristics as we're seeing in the Ebola outbreak in Africa.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very good, thank you.
That's Paul Biadrzycki. He's Director of Disease Control and Environmental Health at the City of Milwaukee Health Department and adjunct faculty at the UW-Milwaukee's Zilber School of Public Health. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In just a moment, in light of the protests that took place in Ferguson, our guest says white people can and should become allies against racism.
First, a traveling exhibit of graffiti drawn decades ago by soldiers headed to Vietnam brought back memories, good and bad, for the veterans who made the voyage. Glenn Moberg reports on their visit to see the exhibit in Wausau.
The ship was not.
The exhibit was brought to Wausau's Woodson History Center by Art Beltrone, a military artifacts expert who stumbled upon it while touring a mothballed troop ship, the General Nelson M. Walker.
It blew me away. Everything was still in place. The bunks, the pillows, the sheets, and on the underside of the canvases were messages.
Messages from almost 60 years ago, each scrawled in felt tip pen on the bottom of a narrow sleeping canvas by a soldier in the bunk below. Beltrone says the authors were working class kids.
They were young kids. They were young Americans. Most of them were 18, 19.
The graffiti is startling. There are profane images of the late 60s, but there's also a complete sonnet by Shakespeare, the lyrics of the anti-war song Universal Soldier, sardonic jokes about death in combat, and appeals to patriotism. There's even a map of Stevens Point drawn by a homesick soldier.
Graffiti, when it's written, is the most honest expression of that person when he writes it.
Art Beltrone was able to save that graffiti and put it into a traveling exhibit called Marking Time, an exhibit viewed by dozens of men from the 2nd Squadron 1st Armored Cavalry, who all sailed to Vietnam on the Walker and who just happened to be holding a reunion in Wisconsin.
The Walker, for all her dents and peeling paint, has always made a bunch of us feel like she was more of a mother.
Dennis Scott may love the Walker and the men who served on it, but he didn't love Vietnam.
The rains of the monsoons and the heat of the non-monsoons and cooking boa constrictors and rotten buffalo.
The graffiti images were published in the American Legion magazine, which was delivered to the Kansas home of Tom and Gay Ann Fay.
I didn't even remember doing it. I evidently let out
a giant shout.
Gay Ann was in the kitchen, so I really scared her.
Tom Fay saw the heart he had drawn with their names and the fateful date of their wedding, August 27th, 1966.
I got my draft notice August 26th. At our rehearsal dinner, we were getting married the next day.
I was 22. His dad handed him the letter with a chuckle. Ha, ha, ha.
Tom Fay had forgotten the heart he drew, but he remembers the General Walker.
Hot, stinky, so bloody hot. Water just ran off of you.
And he remembers what happened when he got to Vietnam.
Brand new lieutenant, had never driven a track before, and he wanted to drive it. He rolled it off the mountain, broke my back.
Jim Hardy was on the Walker in 1967 when it ran into Typhoon Violet, packing 145 mile-per-hour winds.
The waves were 90 foot up about and 90 foot down, so the ship would free fall 180 feet and slam onto the ocean and just vibrate like a gigantic sledgehammer hit it and just shake.
Hardy says the ship's restroom was filled with men on their knees. Some of them were even praying.
Praying to get to Vietnam. I heard troops say, please, God, get me to Vietnam. I got a rifle and I got a chance.
But Jim Hardy says he, too, loved that ship.
It got us there. It was like an old friend. It wasn't a piece of metal.
Looking at the graffiti, Tom Fay and Dennis Scott mostly remember the men who wrote it.
The book, The Band of Brothers. I mean, that's what we are. We're closer than family.
We're friends, the best of friends. We love each other.
And they still love the General Nelson M. Walker. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Yesterday, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced the launch of a broad civil rights investigation into the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department, citing a deep mistrust between officers and the people who live there. Ferguson is a largely black suburb of St. Louis with a largely white police force.
In the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, protests erupted there. The issue struck a nerve nationwide as well.
A lot of that nationwide response pointed to similar kinds of racial segregation and distrust between the community and the police force in communities around the country.
In response, blogger and former attorney Janae Woods wrote an article giving guidance, suggestions to white people interested in becoming an ally of black people facing racism in their own communities. Her article, Becoming a White Ally to Black People in the Aftermath of the Michael Brown Murder, appeared on her blog, What Matters, and on TheRoot.com. She joins us now. Janae, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
Well, you wrote this piece soon after the initial events. What was it about the response that you were seeing going on all over the country in the media and the social media that made you want to write this piece?
Well, I think the first thing I saw was a lot of rage and disbelief from all kinds of people, mostly people of color, And I saw something slightly different from my white friends who were posting about it. A lot of them were also expressing rage, but were also asking, what can I do? What can I, as a white person, do to fight against this kind of racism in my country? Because I don't think that this is right, but I don't know where to start. So I wanted to speak to those people who wanted to become more actively engaged.
And you wanted to encourage people in that category, too, to not sit on their hands and let African Americans deal with the issue.
Yes. I was thinking that this could be a rallying call for all of us to come together, because this system needs to be transformed, and it is not going to become undone unless we all take an active role in dismantling racism.
So what kind of suggestions did you have? What kind of things do you say, hey, you want to be a help? Here's what you can do.
Well, I think the most important thing to do is to first learn about the racialized history of the United States and how communities like Ferguson come to be. We need to educate ourselves and understand that these kinds of killings, this kind of brutality, these are not anomalies or statistical outliers. They are direct products of decades of housing discrimination, white flight from communities, intergenerational poverty, and racial profiling. And a lot of people don't understand how all of those pieces fit together to produce the kinds of states that lead to what happened in Ferguson. And what happened in Ferguson could happen in many other communities across the country as well. We don't know these things because we're not taught about the role that racism plays in shaping our communities in this country. We learn a lot about slavery and about the Civil War, and we learn about the Civil Rights era, but we don't often learn about the institutionalized or structural impact that racism has had on our communities. And a lot of that is a huge factor in what happened here.
Do you get a sense of kind of a split response, white Americans kind of being surprised and shocked and maybe outraged by something like this, whereas African Americans are saying, yeah, we've been kind of seeing this all along, here we go again?
Yes, and I would say that it's something even more deeper than that. A lot of the white people I know were expressing horror and rage over this because this follows on the heels of Trayvon Martin, Amadou Diallo, Eric Garner, and now we have Michael Brown, and they were saying, how can this be happening? We feel like this is happening more and more because it's not their lived experience, whereas people of color are saying, see, this kind of thing, this is what people of color deal with on a daily basis in many communities. It's not a shock to us because this is part of the lived experience of being black in America.
Another piece of advice in your article is that we shouldn't focus on stories that Michael Brown, the victim of the shooting here, was a good kid. Why is that?
Well, because whether he was a good kid or not does not matter. His death was tragic because he was a human being and his life mattered. There's something really attractive about the good kid narrative because it does provoke some sympathy, but what it really does is it supports this kind of false understanding that black people, black men in particular, have a norm of violence or criminal behavior. So the fact that he might have been a good kid makes him an exception to that rule, and that's the exception that says that he did not deserve to die. And I think that is an incorrect way of looking at this situation. He didn't deserve to die because he was a person. And the flip side of that, too, is now some people are saying, well, perhaps he wasn't a good kid. Perhaps he was a criminal. Maybe he stole some cigars or had a scuffle with a shopkeeper. However, that's still not a justification for killing. All lives matter. All black lives matter, not just the ones that we decide are good.
Does that narrative and counter-narrative, this is a good guy, this is a bad guy, whether we're talking about Michael Brown or Trayvon Martin, do you think that distracts from what you're saying are the more fundamental issues at play between police and black communities?
I think so. I think that those kinds of narratives sort of lull people into thinking that we have permission to brutalize black and brown bodies, particularly through the use of police force, because black and brown bodies, particularly male ones, are seen as threatening. So I think that we need to be really mindful about what kind of narratives we set up around these situations so that we don't distract ourselves from seeing the deeper systemic issues.
We're talking with blogger and former attorney Janae Woods. She wrote a piece soon after, in the midst of the aftermath, really, of the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri. She wanted to offer encouragement and advice for white people who were worried about treatment of African-American communities, about conflict between black people in parts of the country and police. And she wrote this piece on how to become a white ally to black people.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. How do you think white people can play a role in combating racism? Can your community relate to what happened in Ferguson? Wisconsin's largest city, Milwaukee, is one of the most racially segregated in the country. How do you think black and white people can work together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with blogger and former attorney Janae Woods talking about how white people can be allies to black people in light of the events in Ferguson, Missouri.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're African-American, how do you think white people can play a role in combating racism? What kinds of racism would you say you've encountered here in Wisconsin? And in general, around the state, can your community relate to what happened in Missouri? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to our callers, Janae, you talked about some ways to learn about this, contextualize things, some ways to talk about it. What concrete actions are you hoping for from people who would want to be white allies, as you call them, in combating racism?
Some concrete actions that would be great to see people taking would to see people forming communities of other people in their community who also want to become white allies and engaging in some shared learning together, some shared reflection together. There are lots of workshops that can help people do these things. If you go online and you look at the website for Training for Change, they have a great workshop called Whites Confronting Racism. There's also an organization called the People's Institute for Survival. They have a workshop called European Descent. There are conferences like the White Privilege Conference, or the Facing Race Conference, which is put on each year by Race Forward, which used to be the Applied Research Center. And lots of these organizations have free resources online that you can use to help you start thinking and talking and having conversations about racism with other fellow white allies. And other things that you can do that are actions that people can start taking right now are to gather together diverse people from your community, not just white allies, but all kinds of people, to have community conversations. You can talk about, well, what's the state of police-community relations in our neighborhood? What is the effect of racism that we're seeing in our community right now? You can get together and have conversations about that using discussion materials that have already been prepared by organizations that have decades of expertise in this area. For example, the organization where I work, Everyday Democracy, has lots of discussion guides and lots of organizing materials for people who want to have conversations about police-community relations where they live or about race conversations more generally, just outside of the police-community relations arena. If you look at everyday-democracy.org, you can find all of those resources on there for free. There are other things that you can do, too. If you go to your local library, they probably have documentaries like Race, the Power of an Illusion that you can check out and take home and watch. You can watch those by yourself or with a group of friends. You can bring together your neighbors to have a conversation about it. I think the most important thing to do is to always be looking for ways to take action, always be looking for ways to be proactive, to constantly be looking for ways to disrupt racism when you see it.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Darren on the line in Boston, Massachusetts. Darren, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
What do you want to bring up, Darren?
Hi, good afternoon to your guest as well. No, I've been watching this story from a distance. I'm from the East Coast. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. And, obviously this is a problem for our entire nation as a whole, not for just Ferguson, not just for Missouri. And when I have heard about the story being, the incident in Ferguson being described as systemic or systematic racism, if we're going to reduce it down to its basic components, you had one person shoot another person, and if we're going to be colorblind about it, that's the approach we have to take. To assume that the white officer was racist because he shot a black 18-year-old, to me, is racist. So if we're going to be colorblind about this, until it's proven to me that the officer's intentions were racist or his motivations were racist, to call it racist is to certainly jump to a conclusion prior to any proof in kind.
Gotcha, Darren. Janae, this was an individual tragedy. It's premature to attach it into a wider context here, he's saying.
And I've heard that perspective a lot. And Darren, I'm also from the Boston area as well, so it's great to talk to a fellow East Coaster. This is a case of an individual shooting another individual. However, you need to look at it in the context. You need to look at it in the context of the situation. This is a situation where the police force is predominantly white. I believe there are only three non-white police officers policing a community that has suffered from housing discrimination, from white flight, and from many instances of racial profiling. There have been lots of articles that have been written, lots of reporting coming out about how the police have racially profiled residents of color in the community for decades now. So I think that when you look at it in terms of being another piece of a pattern, that is where you can start to see systemic racism. You can't look at these incidents in isolation. There are patterns to what is happening here. And of course, I agree with you. Officer Darren Wilson is 100% entitled to due process of law. He is entitled to the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. However, I do think that we need to look at his actions in the broader context of the racialized landscape of America. And unfortunately, even if you wanted to argue he wasn't being overtly racist, he didn't look at Michael Brown and say, oh, I'm going to shoot him because he's black, there are still implicit unconscious biases that are conditioned into us by the racialized nature of our society that can then become tragedies in an instant, like we saw with this particular killing.
Darren, thanks for the I want to jump in and get another caller on, Janae. Darren, thanks. We've got Anthony in Milwaukee now. Anthony, hi.
Hi. How are you this afternoon?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think we always talk in context of black and white, and there's a widespread racism throughout this country, including Hispanics and Latinos, Asians, Hmong, Native American, all have been subjected to racism. But we don't address that. It's always black and white. And I think we have to fan out a little farther with that. I think we need to hold our politicians more close, their feet more closer to the fire, because they are helping racism be promoted in this country. We haven't done anything about Jim Crow laws in the last 25, 30 years. In fact, the 24-hour news cycle has actually perpetuated it with certain outlets that perpetuate white fear among white males, which enhances the racial profiling from these people who don't interact with people other than their own race.
Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. Let's start with the idea he says people need to hold politicians' feet to the fire when it comes to issues of race. Janae, what do you make of that?
Well, I definitely think that's true. I think the politicians are elected by us. They are supposed to serve us. They are supposed to represent our interests. So I definitely think that we do need to call upon our leadership to not only name the problem, but to not shy away from naming the problem when they see that it is a problem, when the people are saying this is something we want to address. And I'd also like to say thank you to this caller for bringing up the point that in America, racism is not just a black-white issue. It is true. There are other groups of people of color who are subjected to racism and discrimination and prejudice in this country. I will say, however, though, that the black-white binary exists so strongly in this country because we do have a legacy of anti-blackness, which is born of slavery. But as our country has become more diverse, other people have also become victims of that prejudice.
Thanks for the call.
And I do think something that politicians should address as well, so that we have equitable opportunity and access for all people, regardless of their racial or cultural identity.
Anthony, thanks for the call. We'll go to Lynn in Eau Claire next. Lynn, hi.
Hi, Rob, Veronica, and Janae. I am the mother of two policemen, and I worry for my boys. They were raised in a very, very open, liberal family. I don't know what we did right, but they became policemen anyway. But that silliness aside, I worry for them because there's copism. My boys go out every day patrolling streets, protecting everyone, and then they've got, like, punks spinning on them, turning slowly, refusing to pull their hands out of their pockets. You don't want to be shot by a cop. Cooperate.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Janae, your reaction.
I can understand that concern as well, Lynn. My oldest brother is a police officer. Actually, my other brother is a newly minted police officer. So I definitely understand that concern. And I do think that one thing that people need to be mindful of is that I don't think that we should be vilifying the police or individual police officers. Instead, I think we should be looking at the institution of policing in this country and looking at, for example, militarized police responses or looking at police protocol to ensure that these kinds of situations don't happen, because we do want everyone to be safe, not only people in communities, but also officers who are serving and protecting those communities.
We'll leave it there for now. Janae, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to blogger Janae Woods about her piece, Becoming a White Ally to Black People. It appeared on her blog, What Matters, and on theroot.com. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for our weekly state news roundup. Today, a look at the latest from the race for governor, a possible new location or revised plan for an iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin, and reaction in the state after an appeals court in Chicago struck down Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban. Our news guy, Noah Ofshinsky, is here. He's WPR's assistant news director. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here. Good afternoon, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. So, big news yesterday, probably the biggest news of the week. The circuit court in Chicago striking this down, and they did it fast.
Very fast, in less than 2 weeks. In fact, after the oral arguments, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, in a unanimous ruling, struck down Wisconsin's gay marriage ban.
And a 40-page decision here. The gist, though?
Basically, they said that this voter-approved referendum violated the U.S. Constitution. And I'm just going to quote directly from the ruling. I think that probably clearly illustrates where the court was going with this case. And the court wrote, quote, "The only rationale that the states put forth with any conviction that same-sex couples and their children don't need marriage because same-sex couples don't produce children, intended or unintended, is so full of holes that it cannot be taken seriously." And that's a quote taken directly from the ruling.
And that was the decision from the judge, Richard Posner, who really followed that line of questioning, and others very critical of the states of Wisconsin and Indiana also in this lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, both during the oral arguments and in this opinion, basically, you know, they're poking a hole in the state's theory that tradition, just because it may be a tradition, doesn't mean that it's protected by the U.S. Constitution. And they point to, you know, previous traditions and previous laws, referring to, you know, laws that existed in history that prevented couples of mixed races from marrying. hearing, that just because it's a law doesn't make it right. Just because it's a tradition doesn't mean the Constitution needs to necessarily support that. And so that was two of their primary rationales. Also, Judge Posner, very concerned with what effect these bans have on the kids of same-sex couples. And basically, he asked the question, you know, why is this ban good for kids? It's actually the opposite, you know, that married parents make for better parents, essentially. And so that was some of the rationale.
So the reaction here in Wisconsin, starting with the office responsible for defending our constitutional amendment here, the Attorney General's office.
Right. So J.B. Van Hollen hasn't commented in really any sort of detail about this latest ruling. In the past, he has basically said that, you know, he's doing his duty to defend the Constitution as it was amended in 2006, I believe it was. His office only said that the Attorney General will appeal the ruling, and that all along he knew it would eventually be decided by the Supreme Court. His office did note in a statement to the media that the stay, which is suspending the gay marriages in Wisconsin, is still in effect until all the appeals have actually been concluded.
And that's a big point, and avoids some of the confusion we had after the initial federal court ruling striking the same-sex marriage ban down. Are people able to go and register for a same-sex marriage license and get married?
Yeah, the short answer is no. In fact, Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald told the Journal Sentinel they are in a holding pattern, essentially.
And that's one of the first, on that ruling I mentioned, that was one of the first offices to start saying, hey, come on down, we'll issue the licenses.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, a few things have to happen before people can officially get married, or those who are already married, as you note, get their marriages actually legally recognized. The state has to ask the Supreme Court to take the case, which the Attorney General says he will do. And if they don't take the case and no stays are issued, people will be able to get married. But if either the Supreme Court takes the case or issues a stay of the appeals court decision, the ability to get married will be put on hold, essentially, until the Supreme Court rules.
Now, there was a 9-day turnaround from those oral arguments to where we are now. It's going to be a longer stretch before any of those things you just mentioned happens.
Right, absolutely. And it's not even clear, you know, what case the Supreme Court, if they decide to take up this case or take up gay marriage in general, mm-hmm. what case it'll be. Because, again, you know, there are circuits all around this country that are taking up this issue of gay marriage bans. And it's unclear, I believe, at this point, you know, what case or cases they will eventually take up.
All eyes are on Wisconsin until the next ruling.
Exactly.
Well, another story going on in the state this week. We've been following, of course, the proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin for some time now, and our own Mike Simonson has been reporting from up there. What's the latest news this week?
So GTAC officials said this week, and GTAC, Gogebic Taconite is mm-hmm. the company that's building the mine, said this week they are considering actually shrinking the proposed mine in a way that it will no longer stretch into Ashland County.
So why? Why are they making this change of plans?
Officials say it's because of the resistance they run into in Ashland County. And just as a reminder, this mine was proposed to be in both Ashland and Iron counties. One of the things that angered GTAC was a $100,000 mining impact fee that the county voted to institute to help defray, you know, some of the costs associated with mining, so infrastructure, you know, things like that.
Clean up afterwards.
Exactly.
That kind of thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So what has been the line from Ashland County through this? How have they been reacting through the process?
Right. So officials in Ashland County haven't been anti-mine so much as just wanting to make sure there are protections in place if one is built. Ashland County officials have said that, you know, that there is an overall unwillingness on the part of GTAC to actually cooperate with them, you know, in order to get the kind of protections that the county would like.
And now when it comes to the environment, we've heard from Mike up there that one of the concerns is asbestos-like fibers in what would be mined, in the ore that would be mined. Is that in Ashland County?
Right, exactly. One of the things we should note in all of this is that this asbestos-like fibers that were found in the mine area were all found in Ashland County. So the possibility of maybe having to deal with that if the mine is built, you know, may also be part of the equation here. We don't know, but it may be part of the equation.
As you mentioned, this was originally supposed to be in Ashland County and Iron County. What's the story on the Iron County side?
Iron County has not done the things Ashland County has done. And in general, you know, has proven to be a bit more open to the idea of the proposed mine.
So what's next in the process?
This actually isn't the latest news or the only news that have come out of the mining issue in the last 2 weeks. We just found out that the GTAC is actually pushing back its plans to formally request a mining permit to actually get started. That was supposed to happen next spring. Now that may happen into the fall of next year or possibly later.
All right. And then one story that's kind of, you know, it's been percolating under the radar, back page of the paper, that sort of thing. I guess we're electing a governor.
What? Are you saying there's a campaign?
There is. There's some kind of race going on. I saw an ad or something.
Or something.
So what is the latest? What are we hearing from the campaigns this week?
Right. So Governor Walker went on the offensive this week, hitting on really two major themes. He attacked Mary Burke, his Democratic opponent, and really actually the entire Madison School Board, of which he is a member, for not embracing...
Of which Mary Burke is a member.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, for not basically attack the board and her for not embracing the Act 10 reforms that, of course, he led. You know, he says the board could have used the money savings from that to help pay for the programs that could potentially improve the graduation rate as well as the achievement gap that exists with black students.
And Mary Burke's response.
Right. So she defended the efforts of the Madison public school system, saying that the graduation rate and the achievement gap is improving and that they're starting to make gains.
And other education news, a hot topic in the race, voucher schools.
Right. So the governor said this week he would support either eliminating or scaling back the cap on voucher schools in Wisconsin. He says he wants more parents in Wisconsin to have choice when it comes to where to send their kids.
Yeah, and this has been a long-running issue here in Wisconsin. There's been some legislation in the last couple of years. Where are we now when it comes to these voucher schools, these school choice programs?
Right, so the voucher school program was initially limited to Milwaukee and Racine. That program has since been expanded by the legislature to include cities throughout Wisconsin with an enrollment cap, at least for this year.
And again, Mary Burke's response on this.
Well, this is certainly one of the issues that separate the two candidates. That much is clear. She has said she would eliminate the statewide program. She does. She is in favor of the one in Milwaukee and Racine, but she would end the statewide program. She points to a statistic that around something like 75% of the students who are taking part in the statewide program never actually attended a public school in the first place. So from her perspective, that sort of undercuts the governor's rationale.
Now, the litany for much of this campaign has been jobs, 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 and the economy. This is a different issue. Why are they going here?
First of all, it's an issue that separates them. I mean, they feel very differently about the roles of voucher schools in the state. And frankly, it's been an issue that has proven to be something of a cash cow for both candidates. They have raised quite a bit of money from those who both support or are against the expansion of voucher schools in Wisconsin.
And does support on voucher schools fall pretty strictly along party lines?
You know, sometimes, but not entirely. There's really a whole spectrum of opinion. There's people who think that voucher schools take away much needed funds from traditional public schools. There are people like Governor Walker who think choice is good, that parents should have choice, especially for low income or at risk students. And there are people who say voucher schools are okay as long as there is transparency and they are subject to the same scrutiny that traditional public schools are subjected to in the state.
We'll see if this continues to be a theme in the race. Noah, thanks for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That's our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, Assistant News Director here at WPR.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.